half an hour, if that sounds right.
I'm good.
So I'll ask Rashid to, you should recognize folks, but probably given the crowd, it will be helpful if you raise your hand, and then if you're recognized, to stand and enunciate your question so everyone can hear it. Professor Khalidi.
Yes, sir.
I was interested in your conclusion concerning the motivation for U.S. and Russian or Soviet actions during the Iran-Iraq War as being a manifestation of Cold War.
Right.
The reason that seems surprising me is that, after all, the Cold War was winding down during that period. Gorbachev was in power and was trying desperately to save the Soviet Union. And I don't have the impression that Gorbachev was primarily a Cold Warrior. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate on that and clarify a little bit?
Well, actually, the Iran-Iraq War went on from 1980 to 1988. And it overlapped with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So if you think back to our administration, we were under the Reagan administration in those years. The Reagan administration, I think, took the Cold War to a new height. The waging of the war we waged in Afghanistan against the Soviet occupation is a manifestation of that. So yes, towards the end of this period, you're right. You had an entirely new spirit in Moscow. The Soviet Union had decided to withdraw from Afghanistan because it was beaten. And the Cold War it was definitely winding down. But certainly in the beginning of it, the last first 4 or 5 or 6 years, if you go back and think of the rhetoric of the Reagan administration, the Cold War was alive in a way it had never been in Washington in the first 6 or 7 years of the Reagan administration. We were fighting. Think about what President Reagan said. He called the Soviet Union an evil empire. He talked about, he projected the necessity of building this extraordinarily expensive missile defense, which we're now 29 years on. The thing still hasn't worked, as far as one knows. And yet, clearly, looking back, it was obvious that the Cold War was near its end. I'm not sure everybody saw that in 1983 or 82 or 84 or 85. Certainly in Washington. I mean, I was living in Washington a couple of those years. The Cold War was alive and stalking the halls of power in Washington in the early to mid 80s, which is when this war, the Iran-Iraq War, was at its height. I can't see very well. Yes, ma'am.
Hi,
Miss.
Ms. Yeah, I'm from Smith College. My name is Ilana. I wanted to ask you if the U.S. was to invade Iraq, what would be Iran or on the road to reconciliation?
Mm-hmm. Right.
How would that affect the Kurds in Lebanon and Israel and Palestine?
Good question. But it involves a lot of big ifs. If the United States were to do a deal with Iran, it would involve what some specialists have called a grand bargain. Because it would have to involve the nuclear question, some kind of control on Iranian nuclear development such that there could be a guarantee it would not lead to weapons development. And I'm not quite sure how you'd do that, but anyway. Not lead to the construction of warheads, because the Iranians already have the delivery systems. They have the missiles. It would have to involve a further development of agreements that already exist, sort of tacit agreements that already exist, about the two key areas where the United States and Iran are in direct, I won't say confrontation, but are in friction, which is to say Afghanistan and Iraq. Both countries bordering Iran, where we have very large numbers of troops, and will have very large numbers of troops for several years, it looks like. And it presumably would also have to include some of these proxy wars, among them Lebanon and Palestine. Now, what I argued in my talk is that these are not really proxy wars. They're seen by the superpowers, or by the Iranians and Americans, let's put it that way, as if they involve proxies. But actually, they're conflicts that have their own specificity. Anybody who looks carefully at what went on in Gaza will understand that it has Israeli and Palestinian dynamics that are independent of Iran or Syria or the United States or Egypt or any other external power, even though those powers are involved. And each one of these is going to be very difficult. I mean, how you deal with the nuclear issue, I'm not saying it's beyond me, but it's not going to be an easy thing to do. And that's central, because that has to do with Iran's fear of encirclement and fear of destruction of its regime. That has to do with Iranian fears of being bullied by great powers that go back hundreds of years. I mean, before our republic, Iran was being bullied by its neighbors, okay? Before our Declaration of Independence, okay? So this is not a, you know, a recent thing. The Iranians sort of said, hey, I don't like being bullied. They've been felt this way for hundreds of years. And they have deep and abiding traumas. And that has to be factored into this nuclear issue. It's not just, you know, Israel is scared of nuclear weapons. The United States doesn't want a nuclear power in the Middle East or whatever motivates people who are opposed to it. You have to understand why the Iranians are apparently so attached to this. And how do you address those issues? So that's not going to be easy. The issue of Iraq and the issue of Afghanistan and the issue of all the countries around Iran in which the United States has huge bases, all the countries around Iran are the locus of major American military bases. Kuwait, Bahrain, the Emirates, Oman, Pakistan. Go country by country. Each of these countries has huge, all of the countries of Central Asia, with one or two exceptions that border Iran, from the north, from the west, from the south, and the east, have major American military deployments. Those are issues that are going to have to be addressed. And those are not issues that solely depend on Iran, because in most cases those deployments are not a function of Iran. Iraq has its own logic, Afghanistan has its own logic, and so forth. Finally, you have to not only disentangle the proxy aspects in Palestine and Lebanon, you have to address the internal conflicts in these countries. I mean, there's a conflict over power in Lebanon. Is it the actual majority, which is probably Shia, or the largest single group, which comes to have a predominant share in power in Lebanon? And what does that do to the concerns of Sunnis or Christians or Druze? And those are not issues that I promise you are easy to deal with. I've lived in Lebanon for a very long time. And anyone who's examined that knows that however smart the people in Washington may be, it's going to be a hard issue to deal with. And the Palestine question, I needn't tell you how complicated that is. Palestinian-Israeli issue. As far as the Kurds are concerned, so it's possible. I mean, a really ambitious, really, really, a president who had nothing else on his mind and a secretary of state who has nothing else on her mind might set the whole first term for dealing with this grand bargain, and they might have enough time to do it. I'm not sure. As far as the Kurds are concerned, their problems are not just with Iran. Their problems are with Iran, their problems are with Iraq, their problems are with Turkey, and their problems are with Syria. There are huge Kurdish populations, Kurdish majorities in districts of each of these four countries. The country where they, in fact, have the only country where they've ever had any form of autonomy, except for one brief period in Iran, is Iraq, strangely enough, where they also were probably the most severely persecuted. And today, because of the American occupation and because of the system we set up, there is a Kurdish autonomous region in the northern part of the country. The question is, how will that Kurdish autonomous region relate to the rest of Iraq as American power diminishes as it will? Will the Kurds be able to leap from one iceberg to another and do a lasting deal with the other Iraqis? Because in the long run, American power is not going to be, I would argue, located in the middle of Central Asia and in the middle of the Middle East. I don't think we're going to have, you know, the kind of power and influence there in 2012 or 2015 that we had in 2003, 2005, 2007. And that's the best case. That's Iranian. That's Iraqi Kurdistan. Look at Iranian Kurdistan. Look at Syria, the Syrian Kurdish areas. Look at Turkish Kurdistan. Each of these is a big problem. How an American-Iranian rapprochement will affect these? Oh, God, I mean, you have to do four separate calculations, actually. And I'm not going
to
do them tonight.
Yeah,
you'd have to be a juggler. In the back, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the analogy of the Middle Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me that among other things, as you were concluding about the declining power of the United States there, it seems to me that there seems to be something a little off about it.
Mm-hmm.
That is the relative power that we're talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And two, and this is, I guess, a little bit unrelated. You used to apparently be a neighbor of someone who taught at the University of Chicago, who's now in Washington.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Any thoughts about the way the Obama administration might be thinking the reset policy?
Yeah.
So there's two questions.
Okay, let me... Let me answer the substantive, the first one first. You're right. The United States and the Soviet Union were global superpowers, or at least claimed to be global superpowers. I argue in the book that actually the United States always was infinitely more powerful than the Soviet Union in a number of ways and in a number of spheres. The Soviet Union had more nuclear warheads and larger armies, but in absolutely every other index of power, the most important of which is, of course, economic. The Soviet Union was a pygmy compared to the United States and allied economies of Western Europe and Japan after the recovery from World War II. Nevertheless, the Soviet Union was, if not a superpower, a great power. And in the areas adjacent to the Soviet Union, was able to project enormous amounts of power. So there's no real comparison in that sense. However, I would suggest to you that the last 8 years have seen a completely unsustainable projection of American power into the Middle East and Central Asia in ways that have proven that the United States actually is much less powerful than the policymakers responsible for that projection thought it was. Now, if you go back and read the quite strange writings of the people who contributed to the previous administration in things like the Project for a New American Century and in their house organs at the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation and so on, you will see a sense of absolutely unlimited capabilities for the entirety of the 21st century. You will see a kind of hubris that I cannot recall since, you know, reading, I don't know, Thucydides about Athens, thinking they could do anything in Sicily. These people really thought the United States could do literally anything. And I think they've been proven to be completely wrong. And they've been proven to be completely wrong in ways that I think show not only that the United States is less powerful than they thought it was, but that in contests between the United States and Iran in the Middle East, Iran may actually be a worthy rival of the United States. In local contests in the Middle East, where the projection of power does not necessarily relate solely to economic power or military power. And the Iranian military is feeble. It doesn't have much of a military. And the United States is infinitely stronger than Iran. But in terms of projection of power in the Middle East, it's clear that in Iraq, for example, in many respects, Iran has more power to decide certain outcomes than does the United States. It's clear that in other countries of the region, Iran is toe-to-toe with the United States. So I'm not suggesting that the parallel is really an accurate one. It's not. Your basic point is, I take your basic point. But the United States was infinitely stronger than the Soviet Union anyway. They were not really evenly matched. B, as powerful as the United States, it's a lot less powerful than the people who threw us into some of these ridiculous entanglements thought it was. And C, on a local level, when they go toe-to-toe, the United States and Iran have shown that, you know, actually they almost look like equals. In Lebanon, the Iranians have outfoxed us at every turn. I mean, they've made the United States look like absolute fools. Iran 3, the United States 0 is the score right now. I mean, the game's not over, obviously, if heaven forbid it continues. And the Lebanese people less than 0. But that's another issue. Now, as far as this question about my former colleague and neighbor, I guess the best way to answer that would be to say that, unlike the apparent beliefs of some people, our current president is not Superman, and he's not the Archangel Gabriel, and he doesn't have the power to change the political constellation of American politics or world politics with a wave of his hand and a few paragraphs of rhetoric. He's very good at what he does, and so far it's clear that he's shown himself to be capable of this office. But in this part of the world that I'm talking about, A, he faces intractable problems, which admit of no easy solution, and B, he is going to be grappling not just with the political contours of the American Congress and the American media and so on and so forth. He's going to be grappling with inherited conventional wisdom. And inherited conventional wisdom has proven so far completely wrong on every one of the issues I've talked about. This is not to say there are not smart people in our government. It is to say that the political appointees who've made most of the decisions at the top levels of our government over the last several administrations have really messed up. Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Arab, Israel. I can go through these things. Now, if you go and talk to the actual military officers, or you go and talk to people in the intelligence community, or you talk to people at the State Department, they're very smart people. And if anybody had ever listened to their advice over the past three or four administrations, we might not be in as bad shape as we are today. But conventional wisdom is extraordinarily powerful on all these issues. And any president has to operate through the experienced former policymakers of his or her party. You know, you're not going to pick completely untried nobodies and make them assistant secretaries at the Pentagon or at the State Department or give them major intelligence responsibilities. They're going to take people who come from their party's stable, and those stables are full of people who are unfortunately afflicted with conventional wisdom. So I'm not saying that it's hopeless by any means, because in the last analysis, a president can push a country this way or that way. I mean, you saw that with Roosevelt. You saw that with Eisenhower, actually. Look at what Eisenhower did to the defense budget, and read his farewell speech, which I quote at length in this book. Eisenhower did a lot. He understood better than any president since George Washington. Surprise, surprise, the two men who had commanded major armies and understood more about war than maybe any American president but Grant and Jackson were two of the smartest about this issue. He understood the danger of what he called the military-industrial complex. He did a lot to decrease American defense spending, more than any American president. At the height of the Cold War, by the way, President Roosevelt, I mean, what he did in terms of the New Deal and what he did in terms of getting this country ready for World War II, understanding the necessity of that. I mean, these were people who moved heaven and earth and moved a frozen political system. So I'm not saying he can't do it, but understand what he's up against in doing it, and understand that he has to have a lot of support if he is to do it. And he has to have it as a major priority. He has to want to do it and believe that it's doable and that it can be done in addition to saving the world from economic catastrophe, which is his main job. And getting reelected, which is his main job. I need somebody over here. Yes, sir. I can't see you, but if you'd stand up, I can see you.
Given the preponderance of U.S. dependency on Middle East oil, unless something dramatically changes in terms of renewable energy, do you really see U.S. policy changing much in the Middle East?
Well, you point to something that I actually have a whole chapter in the book, which I deal with, which is the energy issue. I don't deal with energy as energy. I deal with the American connection with Middle Eastern energy. And I have a long... I'm going to stand up so I can see you. I'm sorry. I have a long section. Doesn't matter. I have a long section on President Roosevelt several weeks before he died on his return from Yalta, spending a whole day with Ibn Saud on the deck of a cruiser that was moored in the Suez Canal. And he did this because he had been a secretary of the Navy, assistant secretary of the Navy in World War I. He understood the importance of oil. And so this dying man spent one of the last his last days on Earth meeting this minor Middle Eastern potentate that nobody considered very important because he understood perfectly the strategic importance of oil. And ever since then, the United States has had a laser-like focus on Saudi Arabia and on oil. So I don't think that that means nothing can change. But I think that our understanding of how the United States and all oil consumers need to have access to this oil has to be changed. It doesn't necessarily involve alliances with repressive regimes. These people can't drink this stuff, you know. They have to sell it. They have to sell it to the world market. And they sell it to the world market, it's on the world market. That's you know, if there was no American relationship with Iran, or sorry, with Saudi Arabia, you probably would have much the same dynamics. Saudi Arabia would be in a different place, however. The other thing is, the United States is not as dependent on Middle Eastern oil or Middle Eastern energy as Europe is. The part of the world that's really dependent, increasingly dependent on Middle Eastern energy is Europe, India, and China. The United States is much less dependent. We're mainly dependent on West African, South Latin American, and American oil and Canadian oil today. Most of our oil imports do not come from the Middle East. The region of the world that's the most dependent, it has almost entirely energy dependent on the Middle East, is Europe. And that's increasingly the case with developing economies in East Asia, which have almost no oil. So, I mean, changing that is going to be enormously difficult. I actually do go into that in the book.
The Caspian Red Sea Basin?
Well, it's seen as it's a linked region. I mean, it's really the same region. I've talked about the Middle East, but as you'll see in the book, I'm really talking about the whole kit and caboodle. Yes, ma'am. You.
I'm a DUS campus in Taiwan Network, and I think this proxy analogy is pretty problematic
mm-hmm.
because in your entire talk, you
Iran,
right.
So it is potential, I guess, invasion that doesn't really like align for anything. It's less a superpower and more another place to invade.
Yeah.
And the fact that Africa is there have been reports that Africa might be the new Middle East.
Right.
There's been a flourishing of like new military bases.
I didn't understand the first part of your question about Iran. Could you just restate what you said? Iran is not a rival of the United States. It's just another target. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It doesn't have, like you said, it has a feeble army. It has,
right.
It's swimming in oil, as some people say. And its own population is not supportive of the government. And I don't know. Well, anyways, I think, though, that it's not, it really undermines the resistance of ordinary, say, in the Lebanon War, ordinary Lebanese.
Mm-hmm.
In southern Lebanon to say that they were taking orders from Iran.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was simply saying that these powers try to use these actors as proxies. I tried to make that clear, that they have a specificity of their own. They're not just proxies. I mean, proof of that could be seen in the Gaza war when Hezbollah didn't fire any missiles. In the fighting from the end of December, the 22-day war in Gaza, Hezbollah fired no missiles. They're much more focused on the Lebanese elections than they are on what the Iranians supposedly want them to do, which is to take the pressure off other Iranian proxies, so-called. No, I'm not suggesting these are really proxies. I'm saying that these powers are trying to use local actors for their own purposes. Now, as I say in the book, what often happens is that the local allies of the superpowers during the Cold War ended up having more influence than the superpowers themselves. The Egyptians got more out of the Soviets than the Soviets got out of the Egyptians. The Israelis often got more out of the Americans than the Americans got out of the Israelis. So to say that such and such an actor is regarded as a proxy by the superpower does not necessarily mean that that is a correct definition of the relationship. So that's the first part of your question. Second part. And Iran, yes, Iran is a weak country, but at the same time, Iran has various forms of soft power, ideology and so on and so forth, A. And B, It has an unpopular regime, but a regime which paradoxically is very strong and very autocratic and has very powerful control over the society.
How does Iran now fit into Afghanistan, like in terms of the Taliban? Iran is not funding the Taliban.
No, not at all. Quite the contrary.
How does your analogy of a simmering Middle East, like Iran just seems to be another sort of
It's not a chess piece because the Iranian Revolution, for the first time in Iranian history, actually established a regime that was completely independent of any external power. Now, the Mossadegh regime was, briefly, but this is a much more secure regime. Mossadegh was brought down by a coup like that in 1953. So Iran is an actor. You're right to say it's not a powerful actor, but it is an actor. It is not a country like, say, Egypt, which is subject to overwhelming American influence but has a certain degree of autonomy, or Iran under the Shah, which was a powerful country, but one which is subject to overwhelming American influence. Or the Soviet, I could give you other examples. Iran is actually an independent country. And to the United States, this is perceived as threatening, partly because of some of Iran's objectives, partly because of the ideology, partly because of the anti-Americanism, which is a result, I've argued, of American policy. Of our
undergoing economic sanctions.
I know that. I don't think an invasion of Iran is going to happen. And if it does, whoever does it will regret it the way Napoleon or Hitler regretted the invasions that they launched. It would be the stupidest thing anybody could do. And anybody who has any sense knows that, including every Iran specialist I've ever spoken to. It would be catastrophic. It would strengthen the worst tendencies in Iran. And it would guarantee that this clerical regime is going to be with us for your lifetimes and perhaps your children's. It's not a thing anybody with any brains will do, and I pray God we don't do it. Yes, sir.
There is speculation in June with the elections in Iran that Mohammad Khatami might get back in power.
Right.
I can't really tell, but his polls there are a little shaky. Do you think that Obama dealing with Khatami will defuse the Cold War just as Obama dealing with Khatami will defuse the Cold War just like Bush dealing with Ahmadinejad?
Exacerbated it, yeah. I mean, one can only hope. I would try and disabuse you of the notion that Khatami would be in power. The person who's in power is the supreme leader. The person who has decisive power in this system is Khamenei. Now, it's true. You have a parliamentary system, and there's a level of popular representation in Iran that's not present in most other Middle Eastern countries, the exceptions of Turkey and Israel. You just don't have that kind of, or Lebanon. The only other countries that really have some real form of parliamentary democracy. But it's parliamentary democracy within a theocratic system in which the supreme guide has some aspects of supreme power. The government makes some decisions, but the Khamenei makes most important decisions. It can have an impact. A lot depends on what this administration decides to do, and a lot depends on the impact of the Iranian elections and how the Supreme Guide chooses to take those election results. And I don't know how that's going to happen. I mean, one of the things I often say is that the job description of a historian doesn't include predicting the future. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, much of this confrontation is in our hands. I agree. If that's what the questioner in the back was trying to say, I agree with her. We picked the fight with Iran to a very large extent. And the best example is what you just said. They were desperately trying at the beginning of the Khatami, last Khatami presidency, to improve relations with the United States. And the Bush administration gave them three slaps in the face and declared them a member of the Axis of Evil. I mean, I can't think, there, I've said his name. Sorry about that. I try and avoid doing that. And this at a time when Iran was actually facilitating what the United States was trying to do in Afghanistan, because it was a visceral opponent of the Taliban regime. So who knows? If there's good sense in Washington, then some of these issues could easily be resolved, and some of them, as I suggested in answer to that question back there, are going to be very hard to resolve, because they involve deep-seated issues for the Iranians. It's not just the United States that feels strongly about issues. The Iranians feel very strongly about some of these issues. All Iranians, by the way. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
But it's actually Europe and the EU, India and China. And just think about...
And all of East Asia, actually.
Yeah, and the economics of it, and sort of, you know, that part of the U.S. interest in there, this is taken from David Harvey, right?
Right.
The interest in there is to control the development.
But that's always been the case.
Right, especially in China and India. But that's the proxy, right? So in some ways, economically,
right.
It's not Iran, but actually the threat of these other economies, like EU, China, and India.
Right? Yeah, and that goes back to World War II. At the end of World War II, when the United States realized that the rebuilding of Western Europe was going to be dependent on cheap, guaranteed, safe, secure, cheap supplies of Middle Eastern oil. But one of the things that I would hope that these failed and misguided military interventions should have taught people is that you cannot control oil in that way. I mean, one of the objectives of our invasion of Iraq was to establish a regime that would give a privileged place to American oil companies. That's not going to happen. We failed in that. It's an ignoble objective. It's a stupid objective. And it's an unachievable objective. I mean, anybody who knows anything about the history of Iraq knows that the Iraqis have struggled to control their oil resources since oil began to be exploited in Iraq in the 20s, late 20s. I mean, hello? You just have to read a little Iraqi history. Now, that's something that the previous administration rigorously avoided doing. Well, we, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, one in six of whom is still not living in his home or her home today, 6 years after the invasion, paid for that. We don't know how many tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, and 4,000 American soldiers, and a country still devastated. Still lower levels of oil production, lower levels of electricity production, lower levels of water supply than the country had in 2003 after 10 years of sanctions. So we devastated the country. We're not going to have permanent bases there. It's not going to happen. The Iraqis imposed a status of forces agreement in the teeth of the opposition of the previous administration, which guarantees there will not be permanent bases. And the Iraqis are giving oil contracts to whoever they please. So you can't do that. I mean, yes, there are people in Washington who will try and do what the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration and the Eisenhower tried to do, and they will fail. Maybe somebody... Two more questions. You look like a student, and you're not a student, I know, but a lot of other people have, too. One, two. Yes, that's it. President Marx has said two more. That's it. He's the president. Right. 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 You can say their name.
A lot of people
Saharan autonomy.
Saharan, no, Moroccan autonomy. And then the Moroccans get a right to vote. The Moroccans living in the occupied territory
right.
of Western Sahara get a right to vote. If they, I mean, in case this referendum gets passed, do you think that the U.S. would be interested in, I mean, do you think the U.S. is really interested in having the referendum passed so that the people under occupation sort of get their freedoms? Do you see a convergence between this and the U.S. has a lot of interest in oil here and
right.
a lot of companies go in, but Western Sahara and Ford still sorry, if the autonomy passes, if the referendum passes, sorry, if the autonomy goes through, a lot of Moroccans might vote against, I mean, for the Western Sahara to be subsumed into Morocco.
Right. Do I see convergence? I still am not sure I understand your question. Convergence between what and what?
The Palestine issue, the occupation issue.
Ah, okay.
Sorry.
That was not completely clear. I can give you a short answer to that, which is no. I would suggest that the specificity of each of these is going to overwhelm any similarities. And the fact is that in the case of Morocco, A, this is a country the United States has had a strategic alliance with for a long time, and B, this is another case of an autocratic regime, a largely, mainly autocratic regime with elements of democracy or parliamentary, that has for long been supported by Washington. And somebody has to, you know, smack conventional wisdom upside the head with a 2x4 and tell them, one of the reasons they hate us is because we support tyrants, autocrats, and kleptocrats. I mean, they don't hate us for our freedom. They don't hate us for our values. They sort of like our values. They like our freedom. There are a couple things they don't care for too much, but basically people the world over, in the Middle East in particular, like most American values. They particularly like democracy, and they hate it when we support tyrants, and we do it again and again and again and everywhere, and Morocco is one of these places. I mean, they have at least elections and something of a free press, but talk to people who've been in Moroccan jails. So I don't think it's going to be the specificities of the Western Sahara that will drive the decision-making. It's going to be this conventional wisdom of the value of Morocco and oil if it's a factor and so on and so forth. And this idea that stability, i.e. tyranny, which boils down to tyranny, is better than, you know, messy democracy. And I, you know, I obviously don't think that's a good idea, but there we are. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And they, you know, I love President Obama. I'll say his name, but I think the greatest blunder he's made, and he said it right from the campaign on,
mm-hmm.
is to accelerate the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So, what do you see as the ramifications of that?
Yeah. I mean, my hopes when this policy was first mooted in the campaign was that this was a sort of a sop. To those who criticized then-candidate Obama for proposing a withdrawal from Iraq. And I was hoping, mistakenly as it turned out, that once in office he would do a bait and a switch and both announce an accelerated withdrawal from Iraq and figure out a different approach to Afghanistan. That simply does not appear to be the case. And this is an example of what I was talking about before. Of, you know, you don't go in and have your own generals and your own admirals and your own chiefs of staff and your own chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You have a military establishment and an intelligence establishment, and so on and so forth, and a ton of conventional wisdom in every one of the think tanks and in all of these places where people bloviate, which say you've got to do this and you've got to do that, and Afghanistan is this and Afghanistan is that. And he has the problem of having held it against the Republicans for not having gone after al-Qaeda. Having all Democrats said, what you should have done is go after al-Qaeda instead of going to Iraq, which, you know, has some logic to it. But how do you go after al-Qaeda? Do you occupy Afghanistan and follow in the footsteps of Alexander the Great, the Tsars, the British Empire, and the Soviet Empire? Not a very smart thing to do, in my opinion. It's not going to work, in my opinion. But there we are. And I find it deplorable that a war that I don't think is winnable, frankly, is going to be continued longer than might otherwise have been the case. understand that if you were to withdraw immediately from Afghanistan, you might well have the same kind of outcome as you had the last time the United States completely abandoned Afghanistan after spending over $1 billion or $2 billion a year on a covert war against the Soviets, which is a bloody civil war in which everybody who was associated with the United States will be have horrible things done to them. And that's one of the things that really quite irritates me about the United States. It goes into countries, it wreaks whatever havoc it may wreak, and then whoever was associated with the United States ends up paying the price. We saw this in Vietnam. I hope we don't see it in Iraq. But if the United States were to disengage rapidly from Afghanistan, that would also happen. And I don't think that would be a good outcome. But our presence there is part of the problem, as it was and is in Iraq. And as and when we diminish that presence, other problems may arise. But at least the problem that is caused by an occupation that has been, in the case of both countries, I think, very, very problematic. In Iraq, particularly problematic. At least that problem would end. But I have no solution for Afghanistan. I can give you a solution for Iraq, which is the most rapid withdrawal possible. Afghanistan, I don't know how to do it. I don't think the president's on the right course, though, myself.